always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Do you remember an inmate named William McLean, also known as July Justine Shelby?
Yes, I know who you're referring to.
Okay. Did he rape a 17-year-old girl or not after raping a 9-year-old boy?
I believe that's what he pled guilty to.
Okay, and then he went to prison, didn't he?
Yes.
And then he decided to transition, and he became a female and started going by July Justine Shelby. Is that right?
Yes.
And Ms. Shelby said, I don't want to go to a male prison. And you sent him to a female prison, didn't you?
5:06 on the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show. Susie Moore, Deputy Managing Editor from RedState.com, is with me today. And Susie, there is John F. Kennedy. Very smart man. He was graduated number one in his law school class. He comes across as a Southern rube, but he's a very intelligent man. And I love when he questions these witnesses because I almost feel like I'm watching Perry Mason or Matlock or
is
something.
Is his middle initial F, though?
What's that?
Is he John F. Kennedy or is
did
he
I say John F. Kennedy?
Kennedy?
Oh, I'm sorry, John Kennedy.
Boy, Neely. I just looked it up.
I was like,
I'm
what
sorry.
Is it? What is it?
Neely.
Neely.
Oh, John.
I was pretty sure he didn't have the JFK.
John
thing,
N. Kennedy. Sorry.
I know. I should have been. I don't mean to take away from it. He's got a way.
I'm
about
glad
him.
You do that because that means you're actually listening to
it's
me.
True. It's true.
I appreciate that.
No, he has got a southern drawl and charm to him that is disarming, and then he goes in for the kill.
He's like a modern day kind of Matlock a little. He needs a
seersucker.
That's what I was going to say. He needs to wear some seersucker suits on his jaunts through the Senate. Our good friend is on the line. He is in Washington D.C. Tim, your thoughts on the clip that you heard, and should John Kennedy start wearing seersucker suits and go ahead and be Matlock there in the Senate?
Listen to me.
I'm very consistent. I'm a very stable genius.
It's time for the Speaker's Stump Speech, sponsored by Hanson's Tree Service at hansonstree.com.
Tim Jones, welcome.
He is quite the barrister. You know, Susie knows this. The way you conduct an excellent cross-examination is you take all the bad things that a witness for the other side will have to admit, and you basically elicit those responses from them with a series of damning leading questions. And that's exactly what the good senator did right there. That was an excellent cross-examination. There was a lot of bad things that witness would have to admit if John Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, already knew the answers to. And he basically just led that witness right off the end of the plank, showing that we basically live in a god-awful horror show right now, known as 2024 America, right? I mean, when are we gonna wake up from this clown show circus that we're in, right? I mean, men are women are men, dudes get to play in girls' sports and break their noses and give them concussions. I mean, I hope we're at the end of this, where we wake up and go, well, that was really a stupid thing for all of us to do.
Tim, along those lines, I do want to follow up on something that's important because, you know, I know that you're, like me, a recovering attorney, but did you ever wear a seersucker suit to court?
So, I actually have a seersucker suit. And I have never worn the complete ensemble because I would feel like I would need to be on a riverboat with a straw hat,
yeah,
singing "Hello, my baby."
Yeah. Do you have the white buck shoes that go with it?
I do not. Oh. So I don't go that far. I wear the coat, I wear the jacket, and I wear dark, usually navy pants. So I wear the jacket, and I'll tell you what, those jacket, the seersucker, it's incredibly comfortable in Missouri summers or in the South, especially when you're in the, you know, July and August.
Tim, isn't there a seersucker caucus in the House?
There is. So, Chris, on Wednesdays, and this is something this goes way back. I think Senator Eric Schmidt, U.S. Senator Eric Schmidt, when he was State Senator Eric Schmidt, was a big fan of this. I don't know that he started this, but he definitely exemplified it and brought it to a different level. And now it's a thing. But it may have started even before Eric and I were there. But Seersucker Wednesday. So on Wednesdays during session after Easter, everybody, men and women, get out their seersuckers, their linens, their plaid jackets, and start wearing their summer wear, even though technically you're not supposed to wear such things until after Memorial Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it.
Thank you. Fashion advice there from the speaker.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I know.
I was going
to
say.
Tell me to stop.
Stop now. Stop on your head. Yeah, I think I've started flouting the Memorial Day rule a long time ago, too. So you, Tim, you are in the swamp, or have been at least, this week. And, you know, there's a lot of, Chris alluded to this earlier in the show, there's been a lot of movement lately on some legislation that seems to maybe be particularly aimed at, you know, encouraging people to vote one way or the other when it comes to November, when it comes to the general election. Do you think we're going to see some interesting legislation come out of this very divided Congress?
You know, I don't know if anything will get across the finish line, but I am happy to see Republicans finally doing Republican things. And whether or not, let's be honest, there's very little, if any, it could be the best idea in the world. And there's very little that Chuck Schumer is going to allow across the finish line if it comes out of the Republican-led House. So let's just say that at the outset. That doesn't mean, though, that Republicans shouldn't try, because after this very kind of bizarre session they've had over the last 2 years with, you know, Speaker McCarthy beginning the session and now Speaker Johnson hopefully finishing it, because I think a motion to vacate at this point, no matter what you may think of Johnson, I think he's trying his best. He was the most probably unlike... He himself would probably tell you that he was the most unlikely choice for speaker and had no idea he was going to end up in that role. Republicans, though, should focus on what they're going to tell the American people they would do if the American people would grant them a Republican Senate and a Donald Trump back in the White House. So I think it's important for them. Yes, people are going to say that this legislation is political, but good public policy makes good politics and vice versa. And it puts a lot of Democrats in a very squirmy position as long as the Republicans can do these things with a straight face, right? For example, border security. That's something that the Democrats are going to say, oh, they're just playing politics. Are they really? Is closing the border down and not having an unfettered, wide open border with a fentanyl crisis, a human sex trafficking crisis, a crisis in cities and towns that are stretched to their limits and can't deal with this crisis. Is that really playing politics, or is that really just good public policy? It can be both at the same time. It also shows Republicans are willing to lead on these things. So what I heard from Congressman Eric Burleson, who I was with last night, and some of his colleagues who joined us at a little after-hours event, was that they're going to try to do their best to, you know, try to avoid the political tag, even though some of it is going to be accused of being just plain politics, but it's going to be good public policy. So having border security and not having a wide open border is good public policy. Yeah, it's also good politics. Having a balanced budget, you know, long term, we're not going to get there. We're not going to get there next year. It's going to take, what, 10 years probably to get back to a balanced budget. But trying to put some fiscal restraint back in. Good energy policy, right? The Biden administration from day one has tried to shut down energy production in this country and wholesale mortgage it out to other countries, mainly a lot of our enemies, not our allies. And so I think that it's good to have this messaging and to show that this is what Republicans can do if you give them more of the levers of government in 2025.
Tim, I have to ask you about the big bombshell revelations that came out of the House Select Subcommittee on the coronavirus pandemic yesterday. We learned that Dr. Fauci and his top advisors were conducting official government business on their private email accounts, and they were figuring out ways to avoid FOIA requests. I just want to read you a couple of quotes here. This was a quote from one of Dr. Fauci's advisors. He said, "I learned from our FOIA lady here how to make emails emails disappear after I'm FOIA'd, but before the search starts. Plus, I deleted most of those earlier emails after sending them to Gmail. This is a quote. This is an email from Fauci, Tim. I ask you both that nothing is in all caps, gets sent to me except to my Gmail. He said sent to his email. That was an email he sent to one of his colleagues. Tim, this is bombshell revelations. If this was a Republican, this would be all over the news. People would be asking for Fauci's head. We know about it, but how far do you think this story can go or will go?
Well, Chris, I'm sure we can count on CNN and MSNBC to do exposés on this all throughout the holiday weekend, right? I'm sure they'll get to the bottom of this and do an entire documentary series on it. No.
I'm holding my breath now.
Yeah. Don't, Chris. You'll pass out. Susie will have to do the rest of the show by herself. So, you know, Chris, when people on our side of the political spectrum come forward with these types of suppositions or these kinds of narratives, that, you know, at first blush, you might think it stretches the bounds of credulity, and everybody wants to immediately say, well, that's just a conspiracy theory. Whoa. It looks like all of the conspiracy theories were true, right? So it makes you, doesn't that make you wonder, did the government tell us anything that had any basis in fact or medicine or science whatsoever throughout the entire pandemic? Or were they just completely making it up and trying to cover their tracks? Chris, this
the
is
ladder.
Looking more. This is looking more and more every single day, month, and year that we get removed from the pandemic, that our government had something, that our government was deeply involved with whatever was going on at that Wuhan lab, that Fauci was likely at the center of it, that there was probably, unfortunately, a lot of taxpayer-funded millions going to a Wuhan lab that was doing things it shouldn't have been, that a viral outbreak occurred, and then everything that occurred since then was diversion and cover-up, right? That seemed to be true. I went to a little award ceremony on Tuesday night up in Washington, D.C. It was the annual Bradley Innovation Awards. One of the awardees was a guy who became famous and infamous at the same time during the pandemic. You know him well. Dr. Bhattacharya, right? Mm-hmm. One of the authors of the great Barrington Declaration, a one-page paper that was put forth by him and two other scientists from Stanford University, right? A well-known place. He put it out as a one-pager, and this was in October of 2020 when we were still struggling and bumbling and fumbling through this, when the government was being the authoritarians that they wanted to be. And Dr. J. Bhattacharya and his colleagues said, whoa, wait a minute. We've now got 10 months of data here from not only the United States, but from around the world. We see what countries like Sweden are doing. Why are we continuing down this path without any foundation? What we should be doing is protecting those who are at most risk, the aged, the infirm, those who have severe maladies and are most likely at risk. But everybody else needs to go back to work. Everybody else needs to go back to school. We need to stop shutting down our economy. He, of course, told us. He said, I received more death threats than I could relate to you over the next several hours. And it turns out, in retrospect, 3 years later, that Dr. Bhattacharya and Jordan Peterson and Scott Atlas and so many of the others that were maligned and attacked, they were absolutely right. And, Chris, this story that you just talked about today, it's another link in that chain to prove that there was a lot of things that Fauci and his ilk knew were going on that they didn't want Americans to be aware of, that we should have known.
Most definitely.
You know, Tim, one of the interesting things, kind of developments in relation to this, is obviously the Republican House has been doing a lot of oversight and investigation on this issue and several others. And that's to be expected, because it's kind of, you know, that's kind of been a cause on the right side of the equation for a while. But now, I wrote an article earlier today, the HHS has basically moved to debar Peter Daszak and EcoHealth Alliance, which is the NGO that he was the head of, that were deeply involved in collaborating with the Wuhan Institute. So this is Biden's HHS moving to debar one of the central figures to, you know, our COVID policy back in the day, which makes me wonder what's going on internally in the Biden administration for them to be making this pivot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Susie, the cover up continues, right? These are not conspiracy theories. These are coincidences that actually lead to facts, right? And this is, you know, when people talked about this years ago, where they said, hey, there's this shell company called Echo Alliance, and it's funded by Fauci because Fauci's getting these multi-million-dollar grants, and he's funding Echo Alliance, and then Echo Alliance. It all sounded conspiratorial, didn't it? It all sounded like a tinfoil hat theory, because it sounded like something out of a science fiction or a Mission Impossible plot, right? It sounded like something Tom Cruise would star in. But now we're realizing, no, it's scientific fact and it's reality. And this is what was going on. And, you know, what else is our government engaged in around the globe? What else is the CIA and the FBI? What else are they doing that are not protecting American interests, but they seem to be up to no good? This is the deep state we talk about. This is the uniparty that we talk about that seems to always be one of covering their tracks. Why don't we still know? Why isn't there like a Warren Commission for COVID, right? Why isn't there something out there, a bipartisan committee that's trying to get to the bottoms of which? I cannot believe that we can like pinpoint certain things on other planets and we can't seem to figure out where exactly did COVID come from, for sure. Now, we all have our theories, right? And they're probably pretty good ones. Wuhan lab funded by Echo Alliance. But why hasn't a report come out that says exactly that? And now what you just point out, the Biden administration seems to want to be removing some of the chess pieces from the chessboard. So maybe we never actually get the answers, because then the Biden administration would be subject to the implications of being involved in it.
Tim, we have a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask both you and Susie this question, because you're both lawyers. We talked a little bit about this during the break, Susie and I did. Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, of course, who is on trial for bribery. The judge in his case is weighing whether Menendez is protected by the Constitution speech or debate clause. Susie brought up a great point that maybe he's using that excuse because he is, of course, being charged with being an agent for a foreign government. And can he use some of the things he said on the floor there to protect him from this indictment, from this case? What do you think?
Yeah, he's a very clever guy. He seems to be the cat with nine lives. Let's remember, he had a very serious investigation against himself not that long ago that he was able to pull off, his lawyers were able to pull off a hung jury from. So I would never count Wily Bob Menendez out, right? Even though, Chris, we talked about, all these things that are always in the public square, you know, we look at them, we go, wow, gold bars stacked in, you know, he's doing internet searches for what's the price of gold bullion. He's got stuff, sewed up in suit coats and stacked up in boxes. None of that matters except what is actually presented in the walls of the courtroom and what comes in as evidence. And yes, there are certain tricks of the trade that a guy like him could deploy. And that speech and debate clause thing is perhaps one of them that he'll maybe skillfully use for some sort of immunity protection for some of the things he may have said or done regarding this Foreign Registered Agent Act. I don't know a whole lot about the FRA. I just know enough about it to be dangerous. But look, Bob Menendez has probably hired some of the best federal attorneys in the region. And if they can find reasonable doubt to put into the jury's mind, that's exactly what they're going to aim to do.
You want to put a cherry on that, Susie?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I told Chris earlier when he asked about it, I said, you know, I haven't looked into this, but I think that's a pretty clever strategy, and it may work to them. I have trouble believing Bob Menendez had zero conversations off the floor in relation to whatever he was advocating for, supposedly in exchange for these gold bars and such. But the one thing he's got going in his favor is that apparently the Southern District New York courthouse is falling apart, because they've delayed his trial for a week because first there was flooding in the courthouse, and then there was the jurors got stuck in an elevator.
Coincidence?
Yeah, I don't
know. All right. Tim Jones is in the swamp, Washington, D.C. You'll be back with us tomorrow, Mr. Speaker?
Yes, sir. Yes, on my way home today. And I want to thank Susie for sitting in this week, and Chris keeping all the lights on, you and Joey, and looking forward to seeing you guys as we head into the Memorial Day weekend.
Safe travels, my friend. Stay there. Stay safe there in the swamp, and we'll see you back here on this here radio.
Absolutely. See y'all tomorrow.
Excellent. 5:25 on this groovy Thursday. Something I just made up there, Julie. I know that wasn't in the script.
Ron Clutho's going to sue you out of existence.
He is going to sue me. We're going to be speaking with Ward Clark. He is a contributor at RedState.com. And as it says on my sheet here, a noted Alaskan. We'll speak with him more about that. And the Uvalde school shooting. He had an interesting article on Red State about the settlement today. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.
Robbed elementary victims' family stood behind their lawyer, Josh Koskoff, Wednesday. He announced they reached a $2 million agreement with the city of Uvalde.
Instead of suing the city and jeopardizing the finances of anybody, the families have accepted simply the insurance.
Koskoff said the victims' families did not want to hurt the financial status of the city they still live in. The agreement also included a promise to improve training with current and future officers. May 24th will be a city day of remembrance and a memorial will be built. The city will also pay for the upkeep of the children's graves.
5:31 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. And that report there telling us about the settlement that Uvalde family victims received from the city. We have on the line with us Ward Clark. He is a new guest on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. He is a contributor at RedState.com, and he is a noted Alaskan. Ward, my first question I have to ask you, I have never been to Alaska, but those of us in the lower 48, we have the impression that it is 27 degrees year-round in Alaska. Is that true or false?
That is false. It's getting up into the 60s on nice days here right now, and it's still down in the 40s at night. But our summers are beautiful, but they're short. I'm fond of telling people we have four seasons here, June, July, August, and winter.
Is it? Ward, you heard that clip there about the Uvalde settlement. You wrote an article about that, and we talked about it during the break. I asked Susie, who is our attorney, of course. I said $2 million seems like an awfully small settlement for that many people that were involved. I'm sure others probably thought that same thing. Set us straight on what's going on there, Ward.
Well, the $2 million is kind of an opening round. And granted, I suspect, and this is just my personal thought, trying to put myself in the shoes of some of these families, that it's not all about money for them. It's about making sure something like this can't happen again. The Uvalde police, their reaction was shocking. They literally stood outside while shots were being fired. My understanding is, I've never been a policeman, but I've been a soldier, and you run to the sound of the guns. You go in and you oppress it and you stop the event. They just didn't do that. Now, the attorneys for those families also announced that they're suing 92 individual Texas police officers. They're suing the school district and several employees of the school for different failures responding to the shooting. So they're not done yet. They're still going after more people. They intend to make sure that that this kind of thing won't happen, at least not in Uvalde, ever again.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, too, because if they're suing the officers and the officers are employees of the city, presumably it's city money that's going to be defending those officers. So this may just, as you said, Ward, just be kind of the opening salvo and sort of an effort to, you know, bringing some closure, at least. It's hard to believe it's been 2 years since that, though.
Yeah, that's amazing. And they did put in the retraining, which I won't speculate on that until we see what kind of form that retraining is going to take.
Right.
Ward, you had wrote an article, too, talking about, and it's today's article, how retailers are taking matters into their own hands to combat retail theft rings. I don't know if it's as bad as it is up there in Alaska as it is here. But, I mean, you can't go to a local Walgreens and buy, like, laundry detergent or razors or just everyday items now are big commodity items because people steal them and resell them. I remember about a month ago I saw this anti-theft device that this company was showing to different retailers, where whenever a theft was detected, the whole store would fill up with this fog that you couldn't see anything. And so the perpetrators trying to commit these mass thefts would be locked into the store and can't see anything. You can't take what you can't steal. Your thoughts on that and your article?
That's an interesting. I hadn't heard about the fog method. That mm-hmm. seems like a pretty good. Maybe replace it with tear gas
after hours, or poison gas if you want to just go all the way.
We do actually have the problem to some extent here in places like Anchorage. If you go into, say, one of the two Walmarts in Anchorage, and we don't go down to Anchorage very often, it's an hour and a half away from us. You'll see exactly the same kind of things. You'll see, you know, smaller high value items behind, you know, hardened glass or plexiglass or metal bars. Even in Wasilla, I went to buy a bottle of 3-in-1 oil, which a small bottle costs like $12, and I had to have a clerk open up a cage and get me a 3-in-1 oil out of a cage.
Wow.
Up here in the valley, you know, the little stores, little local community places, you don't see it so much. There are people who will shoplift, but they tend to get, you know, small towns, they tend to get ostracized pretty quickly, and they either stop doing it or they move along.
Hmm. Ward, share the story that you put in your article about the clerk at the Three Bears store.
Oh, yeah. Our Three Bears stores are, well, they're kind of an Alaska thing. There is one in Montana, but it's an Alaska chain. Our local one down on Pittman Road, we go there every couple of weeks to pick up, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables and things like that. And I will frequently stop and talk with a manager who tends to be standing out by the front door. He's a big guy. He's probably in his mid to late 40s, broad-shouldered, retired Marine. And I asked him, you know, I mentioned some of this stuff to him. While we see it up here, we don't see people pushing shopping carts of stolen stuff out, even in Anchorage here. At least we haven't yet. And I asked him, what if someone tried that here in your store? And he held up one big fist and he said, nope, it's not going to happen here. And I'd be willing to bet, knowing rural Alaskans, that he'd have some help. There'd be three or four people jump in and grab anyone who tried to walk out of our Three Bears store with a bunch of stuff.
Speaking with Ward Clark, a contributor at redstate.com and a noted Alaskan giving us the flavor up there in our state. Ward, you also wrote an article about Donald Trump's rally today that he's having in the South Bronx. We look at the polls and we see that Trump is doing very well. And usually in politics, when that happens, you think that you can expand the map. And so we see that with President Trump in the South Bronx, which they tell me is probably the most Democratic area in New York. As I asked Susie earlier in the show, is this a good use of his time and resources?
Well, he's there in the New York area. And the thing is, as I pointed out in my article, Donald Trump is a creature of New York. He grew up there. He lived most of his life. People tend to try and read a lot of things into Trump. And I had someone tell me back in 2016 when he was first running that the thing about Trump is there's no real angle. He's not angling for any advantage like regular politicians do. They said, once you remember that he is basically just a real estate guy from Queens, then you'll understand him a little better. So he is on, in a certain way, kind of on his home ground in New York. I think it's a very long shot. You know, he claims maybe he can flip New York. I'm very skeptical about that. But if anybody could do it, it would be Trump. And if there's any time it's going to happen, it'll be this year. And the last time New York went Republican in a presidential election was 1984. And if you remember that, I remember very well that historic 49-state landslide in Ronald Reagan's reelection.
That is the first election I ever voted in 1984 as an 18-year-old kid.
I wasn't old enough yet. Barely.
It was my second.
There you go.
First one I voted for Reagan, too.
There you go. Ward, one of the topics that you cover frequently, and it's in part, I think, your scientific background lends itself to it, is, you know, green energy stories and climate change related stories. And recently, what our audience may not know about you is that though you are currently in Alaska and you are a former Iowan.
Mm.
And unfortunately, earlier this week, there was a terrible tornado that kind of blew through Iowa and had a little something to say about the green energy there, didn't it?
Yeah, it took out a whole swath of those huge, ugly windmills. Two of our kids still live in Iowa, and they weren't affected by those storms. But they run down to Des Moines every now and then for various things, and they drive through those fields. And yes. I hear especially our oldest daughter complaining about those, as she puts it, those big, ugly windmills.
They're everywhere,
cluttering up the landscape. And now so many of those horribly expensive things have been destroyed. The blades are broken up. The blades can't be recycled. They go into a landfill somewhere. There's piles of these things sitting around. The generation apparatus is burned up. It's no good anymore. They might be able to recover some materials out of it, I suppose. But it's just another example of not only are these things unreliable. I had another article some weeks back about how wind power generation across the country has dropped because last year wasn't as windy as it usually is. So they're unreliable, and now that we find out, got a very good lesson on how vulnerable they are. Mm. I mean, a hailstorm. Imagine a solar panel farm, and a good hailstorm comes along. And they have a lot of those in the Midwest, too.
They do. Ward, you also wrote an article talking about, and I didn't hear about this, Louisiana lawmakers have passed a ban on abortion-inducing drugs. We know that is a case right now before the Supreme Court. Could this all be for naught, Louisiana passing this law?
I'm a little skeptical of the law because those drugs have other purposes. And they aren't banning the drugs. They just reclassified them. Mm-hmm. They reclassified them to what they consider a restricted and dangerous substance, which is kind of on a par with at the federal level, something being considered a restricted drug. And at the federal level, and in my previous career, I worked with the FDA a lot. I know the FDA's operation fairly well. They consider those that classification being for things that present a danger of addiction. That's kind of their key criteria for that. These drugs don't really fall into that, and they do have other uses. So I'm a little, I reported that, and I kind of tried to stick to just the facts of the case because I haven't quite made up my mind. There's a federalism issue, Louisiana, as a state, that's the appropriate level for these kinds of decisions to be made. And Louisiana also has very restrictive laws on abortion, some of the most restrictive in the country. And if people in Louisiana don't like that, they've got 49 other states to choose from.
Ward, you're one of our more prolific writers, and you happen to be writing normally when I am one, maybe the editor on duty. So I'm very familiar with Ward's work. I edit quite a bit of it. But one of the other stories that you wrote on today that kind of caught my eye, and we covered it maybe back at the beginning of the year, but now it's kind of heating up. There were parents in, I think it was Montana, who lost custody of their child because they wouldn't agree to affirm the child being transgender. Tell us a little bit more about that.
They had a religious objection, and it didn't. The story that I based that on, I wasn't able to determine what denomination the parents are. It doesn't really matter. The First Amendment guarantees them that right. That was a travesty. That whole thing. The child was taken away with no due process. There was no warrant. The parents are pursuing legal action. And actually, I should point out that it was the father, the girl, I will not call that child a boy. That child is not a boy. She's a girl. Even Fox News, bent to that and was referring to the child as he. The child is a she. She's a girl. But it was the biological father and a stepmother. The child apparently now is in Canada with her biological mother. And not sure what's going to happen with that child in Canada, which has a little bit different outlook on those things than the United States does. But it was a horrible. The parents were basically denied their First Amendment rights. They were denied parental rights. We all have the right. We expect to be able to raise our children as we see fit, not as Child Protective Services see fit. The child didn't appear to be in any imminent danger. There was a suicide attempt, but the child recovered from it. I will say the child was under no danger from the parents, but they lost her anyway.
We have been speaking with Ward Clark, redstate.com contributor and noted Alaskan. You can reach him on X at The Great Lander and on Red State, Ward Clark. Ward, thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to having you back again on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. Have a great weekend and holiday.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ward.
I like Ward. Ward did a good job.
Yes, he did.
Did a very good job. He's kind of got a radio voice a little bit there. I just noticed very smooth.
Yeah.
Smooth there. So 5:45, one broadcast segment left before we turn it over to Larry Connors, USA. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
The attorneys representing American Airlines claimed that the 9-year-old girl should have known that she was being secretly recorded in an airplane restroom. An American Airlines flight attendant was arrested in January and indicted by a federal grand jury in April. Court documents say he recorded young girls after guiding them to first-class restrooms, where his iPhone was hidden behind stickers taped to a toilet seat reading, "Seat broken." A 14-year-old girl caught on during a flight from Charlotte to Boston last September. The FBI confiscated Thompson's phone. It identified victims ranging in ages 7 to 14.
5:50 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show, and I think that story there just confirms that there are some very weird, sick people in the world. If those that of you that were looking online at the stream, you know that Susie's look on her face just about says it all. Susie, go.
I want to know who the lawyers are who recommended as a defense to American Airlines that they should say she, the 9-year-old, should have known that there was a hidden camera. There's got to be more to that story. There is no sane lawyer that on the planet that would say, I mean, that's not victim blaming. Yeah. That's like, I mean, that's beyond victim blaming.
And even if I will stretch this to the nth degree to maybe kind of justify it, maybe not for a child, but maybe if an adult was like, wait a minute, would they send this plane off on a trip with a broken toilet? They wouldn't do that. Something is amiss here. You know, maybe they may have to take it to that degree. I don't know.
It doesn't fly no matter who the victim of it is. It could be an adult, a male, female. It doesn't matter. Honestly, the bottom line is this. You're talking about a restroom. You're talking about a reasonable expectation of privacy. Mm. No one should be being filmed in a restroom without their consent. And to try and lay it off on the person who was the victim of it, particularly if that person's a child, is just abhorrent and ridiculous. So I want to know who those attorneys are, and I want to find them online and point and laugh.
Write a Red State article. Write a Red State article.
You might see one out of me about this, because I've got something to say.
I love it. Joey came in with that old song there, and Joey is a master at finding songs that have eventually been sampled into rap music. Of course, that was Jeezy's song, Gold Digger.
Kanye West.
Jeezy. That's not Jeezy. I'm getting old.
Jay-Z.
But anyway, what was the name of that song?
Well, that song is called I've Got a Woman by Ray Charles.
I've Got a Woman. Okay.
1958.
I've got a story about women here, Susie.
Okay.
Mattel. What are the odds? Mattel is producing Barbie dolls that are depicting Venus Williams and 8 other athletes who have, quote, broken boundaries and encourage girls to stay in sports, according to Axios. These one-of-a-kind role model dolls are part of a program at, quote, leveling the playing field for girls globally in sports and beyond. Do I need to even go further? Where am I going?
Yeah. Where are all of the role models that they're going with? Are they all actual biological females? Because that seems to be not the popular thing right now.
And it's like, you're kind of missing your focus here. You want girls to stay in sports, but you people are encouraging guys to play women's
stay in sports so the boys can beat you up. What the heck?
Exactly. Yeah, I knew. I was like, Susie.
Sorry,
probably
I'm
knows.
A little animated right now.
Susie, like Susie knows exactly yeah, exactly where I'm
that,
going
like,
with that story.
Just a second now.
Susie, did you know that daily marijuana use? Listen to this. You know, we're at the end of the show, so I don't want you to sit down. But this is one you may have to sit down for almost. Daily marijuana use has outpaced daily alcohol consumption in the U.S. for the first time.
You know,
does that surprise you? Not surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me just because it's become so, it's first of all been legalized so broadly, and it's kind of the trendy thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, right or wrong, there are people who will tout the medicinal properties of marijuana, THC, which it does have some of. So, no, that doesn't really surprise me.
It says more people still drink alcohol than consume marijuana, but I guess on a daily basis.
I don't know how you...
That's what I was wondering.
How do you do apples in terms of consumption? Because you're talking about a weed and you're talking about a liquid. I don't know. I don't know how they're comparing those. It doesn't surprise me. I'm sure I know my neighbors do because I can smell it all day long.
It says daily or near daily marijuana use grew by 269% from 2008 to 2022. That was a Carnegie Mellon professor, Jonathan Calkins. Here's one. You know, once we thought we had got rid of George Santos, right? There cannot be another fabulous in the United States House, right? You're wrong.
No.
We have another George Santos in the House. His name is Andy Ogles. He's a Republican from Tennessee. He has refiled 11 amendments to his Federal Election Commission reports. He says that he loaned his campaign $320,000 in 2022. It actually was only $20,000. He has misrepresented his educational and professional credentials. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah.
Susie, including his claims to be an economist, a trained law enforcement officer, and an expert, quote, in international sex crimes. And here's one that may sound familiar, too, if you follow the George Santos case pretty closely. It was also discovered that he used the stillborn death of a child to raise nearly $25,000 for a children's burial garden that was never built. Ogle has refused to provide evidence of what he did with the money. So it looks like we've got another George Santos there.
Wow, I'm just kind of surprised I haven't heard about that. That's kind of crazy. I could do a story about that too.
It is. And let's see what we got here next. Did you know that you can make predictions on elections? But it may not be, you can't do it coming up. They're going to make it illegal. Election prediction markets may be forced to shut down before November. This is from the New York Times. Betting on pretty much everything is everywhere in America. The one exception, politics, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission has ordered a ban on financial exchanges known as prediction markets, where it's possible to make wagers on who will win the 2024 presidential election. You've got Predicted, the best known form for election wagers. It's run in New Zealand for profit. And another exchange, the Iowa Electronics Market, is operated by the University of Iowa, but it will get an academic exemption from the agency's crackdown. So
interesting.
You can bet on anything.
Oh, yeah, nowadays. You can. You sure can.
Larry Connors, USA, is up next from 6 to 8. After that is the Rob Carter Show. You have been listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9 94.1 News Talk SDL. Drive safe and have a great evening.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.